Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, we look back at Japan's devastating earthquake and the ongoing problems with its Fukushima reactors.
Number one is very close to totally melted. But two and three, probably partially, but not so small.
Also, Frankfurt Airport's model sniffer dogs for wildlife products and the volunteer program to save sea turtles in one of their most important Atlantic habitats.
Paola and her colleague need to work quickly while the turtle lays her eggs.
The first thing that I can do is take a sample of this.
And we also visit the topic of greenwashing today. I'm Nathan Witkop. I hope you stick around. The 11th of March this year was a day like any other in Japan until about 2:30 in the afternoon. Then the largest recorded earthquake in Japan's history struck the country's northeast coast, generating a huge tsunami that devastated nearly everything in its path. Flooding the Fukushima nuclear power plant, it set off a series of failures, resulting in meltdowns. This weekend will mark 6 months since the catastrophic chain of events, and Japan is still coming to terms with their consequences. Zulfikar Abani reports.
I never experienced an earthquake like it. Where I work, there are fissures through all the walls.
The 9.0 magnitude quake off Japan released an enormous amount of energy, shifting the country's main island of Honshu nearly 2.5 meters eastward. Buildings were damaged across the country's northeast, but most held steady. At least until 30 minutes later, when the next disaster struck.
Out of the helicopter, you can see how the sea is flowing across fields and taking cars and buildings with it. These pictures are from Sendai, 5 kilometers from the coast. Even here, large buildings are affected.
The tsunami reached up to 30 meters in some locations. It flattened whole towns along Japan's Pacific coast and, together with the earthquake, killed some 20,000 people. It also caused a critical failure at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. A 15-meter surge of water engulfed the facility and cut the electricity needed to cool the plant's reactors, triggering meltdowns in the three that were online at the time.
An instruction has been issued to residents within a radius of 3 kilometers to evacuate. Please stay calm and cooperate with local police and fire services.
It was just the first evacuation notice to be announced by a government that increasingly seemed powerless over the situation. The evacuation radius was extended to 10 kilometres, then 20 kilometres. It has since become clear that it will be decades before it is safe enough for residents to return to some areas around the plant. Hajimu Hamana is a professor at Kyoto University and heads a government-appointed panel tasked with overseeing the dismantling of the Fukushima site.
Another regrettable failure relates to the electricity supply. The backup generators were located in the basement, which became flooded. Additional emergency power lines failed. When Fukushima 1 came online in the early 1970s, it met safety standards then. But TEPCO should have retrofitted its facilities. Why didn't the tsunami and earthquake have the same impact on the nearby Fukushima 2 plant? It was built differently. Nor did the state force the operator to retrofit its facilities. Regulations weren't tightened. TEPCO did this voluntarily, so why didn't it invest in the safety of Fukushima 1?
Another independent committee is determining responsibility for the disaster. But it's already clear that safety standards were deficient and that there was a lack of any real supervisory authority. Some observers felt that the state, energy operators, and regulators were more keen to hold on to a shared interest in the promotion of nuclear energy. Meanwhile, the exact state of the reactors remains a mystery 6 months on. Yamana again.
Number one is very close to totally melted. But two and three, probably partially, but not so small. I think it's clear that in the unit one, it is already passed through to the bottom of the containment vessel. But three and two, I'm not sure.
Yamana says it will likely take more than a decade to remove the fuel rods from their containment chambers and to dispose of the melted cores properly. Before this happens, the Japanese government will need to agree on a range of decisions, including where to put all the radioactive debris from Fukushima. Akiko Yoshida from the Japanese branch of Friends of the Earth says public opinion has shifted away from nuclear power.
Opinion polls in March suggested nearly half the population opposed nuclear energy. That has grown gradually over the past few months, and now more than half the population is against nuclear power. It's only in the aftermath of Fukushima that people have turned around and come to accept that we can't continue this way with atomic energy.
Recent polling suggests people in Japan want to see a long-term transition to renewable energies, but only 10% want to see an immediate end to nuclear power. The three-part catastrophe of March 11 made many Japanese close ranks, according to Ryoichi Hattori, head of Japan's Red Cross.
Within 1 month of the disaster, donations amounted to nearly 1 billion yen. We only reached this level of donations for the Kobe earthquake after a whole year. People really dug deep into their pockets to help out.
So far, over 2.5 billion euros have been raised in assistance. Nearly everybody from the affected regions has found temporary shelter. Much debris has been removed from the worst-hit residential areas of coastal cities, but it's a different picture for many factories that still remain buried under rubble some 6 months later. Zulfikar Abani, Deutsche Welle Radio.
To some exotic animals now. The trade in illegal wildlife products, which can range from peculiar pets to skins and rhino horns, can earn a smuggler a lot of money in Europe, but it's also a serious threat to endangered species. To tackle this, Frankfurt Airport here in Germany recently began training dogs, usually used to sniff out drugs, to search for this other kind of contraband. It's been having a lot of success, and other European airports are taking note. Holly Fox has more.
Kara is an 8-year-old black German shepherd. She works with customs at Frankfurt Airport, using her powerful nose to sniff out drugs, weapons, cash, and even wildlife contraband. She's found something. When Kara gets excited about a certain suitcase, her handler opens it up to see what's inside. This time, it's only a test. But since customs began using sniffer dogs to look for wildlife contraband, they've come across illegal animals or animal products 250 times. Klaus is Kara's handler.
I was checking a load with Kara, and there were two suitcases that she showed she was interested in. Her behavior was different, so I opened the two suitcases.
Inside each suitcase was a canvas bag.
At first, I wasn't sure what it was. There was a sharp, acidic smell, and I thought it was acetone. I thought I'd found drugs. I took a knife and I opened one of the sacks. And then all of a sudden, the leg of a tortoise pops out and starts moving around. That was really bizarre.
Frankfurt Airport has been using sniffer dogs for 35 years, but only began using them for wildlife contraband in 2008 after being contacted by the World Wildlife Fund. The customs office was eager to help, and they began training the dogs to find wildlife products using animals and things that smelled like animals from the Frankfurt Zoo. They found a rhino horn, eggs from rare birds, stuffed turtles, and endangered snakes preserved in bottles of wine. Birgit Brown is a project coordinator with WWF and spearheads the program.
Illegal wildlife trade is a $1 billion business. The dimension of illegal wildlife trade is threatening the survival of species around the world. So because of that, it's very important also to fight illegal wildlife for species conservation.
In fact, seizures across the EU are on the rise, according to TRAFIC, a joint organization which tracks the illegal wildlife trade. This could indicate a growing problem or just better detection by authorities. Either way, the effects of illegal trade on endangered populations can be devastating. For example, the number of critically endangered Egyptian tortoises seized just in the EU between 2001 and 2005 is believed to represent about 13% of the total estimated wild population. Yet conservationists have a powerful ally. Brown says the dogs are faster and more effective than any technology the airport could use to search the luggage.
The nose of a dog is very powerful. They can smell 1,000 times better than humans, and so they are powerful weapons to find hidden wildlife products.
Once the suitcases are unloaded, a trained sniffer dog like Kara can check up to 350 suitcases in 10 minutes, according to Dieter Keller, the head dog trainer at Frankfurt Airport.
The passenger, while we check here, the passenger leaving the plane and going to the airport building, yeah? He doesn't know that we work in here. And in this time, we check the luggage, and when we find, we can catch the passenger. It's very easy.
Keller says the German program is the most successful one to date and that other customs agencies in Europe are looking to follow its model. He thinks the next step is to get all of the European Union on board, while also increasing cooperation with the countries where these animals and products are coming from.
The new idea is to protect Europe. Europe, while Frankfurt is the door to Europe, a big door to Europe, we are at the beginning. Now, we have to think global. Now, we have to think not German. Now, we have to think global. We have to think in European.
The WWF's Birgit Brown agrees.
The EU is one single market, so we have to improve the fight against illegal wildlife trade in the EU and not only in one single country. If professional smugglers know that there are good control systems established at Frankfurt Airport, they will easily switch to other international airports somewhere in the EU. And because of that, it's really important for us that the model project from Germany and other countries will spread out to all EU member states.
Already, several EU countries, including the Czech Republic, the UK, Austria, and Italy, are taking part, and Hungary is about to begin its own sniffer dog program soon. Holly Fox, Deutsche Welle Radio, Frankfurt Airport.
And a reminder, you're listening to Deutsche Welle Radio's Living Planet, coming to you from Bonn in Germany. To some other threatened species now. There are 7 types of sea turtles in the world, and 6 of them are considered endangered. The West African archipelago of Cape Verde is a special location for these creatures, where 5 different types of sea turtle can be found. But they're also hunted here by locals interested in their meat and eggs. Since 2008, the Turtle Foundation has been working on Cape Verde's Boa Vista Island to save the turtles. Carla Fernandez visited one of the island's beach camps and went on a night patrol with the volunteers.
10 p.m. It's windy and dark at the Turtle Foundation's camp on Boa Vista. 3 volunteers and I are walking along the sandy beach of Curral Velho to see if we can find any turtles preparing to nest. We spot one turtle, and 2 volunteers start walking faster to see what she's up to. After a while, Paola, the team leader, comes back.
The turtle is putting the eggs. If you want, you can go near the turtle, and with the lamp you can see the putting of the eggs.
Paola and her colleague need to work quickly while the turtle lays her eggs.
The first thing that I can do is take a sample of tissue for a research of some volunteers that are in this camp. It's a very quickly operation, and I can do while turtle is putting the eggs. All the other operations after the putting of the eggs during the camouflage.
After laying her eggs, the turtle uses its fins to cover its nest with sand. One of the reasons why turtles prefer sandy beaches for nesting. The nesting season starts in June and finishes in October. During this period, volunteers patrol the beaches because the turtles are most vulnerable when they leave the sea to lay their eggs. The foundation's main concern is discouraging the locals from hunting the turtles. Christian Rode is the organization's project manager.
In
the long term, we want these patrols to become superfluous. We want the locals to see that they don't need to hunt these turtles and that they can benefit more if the turtles survive. The turtles aren't a significant source of food here. They're just a small revenue stream. No one will starve if they don't eat the turtles.
The young German activist studied biology partly in Bonn and has been managing the Turtle Foundation's activities here since 2008. Many of the volunteers at the Lacacombe Beach Camp study biology or work in related areas. Amanda, for instance, is Brazilian and has come back for a second season. She studied oceanography, and this year she's the camp coordinator. She points out another threat that the sea turtles face.
One of the recent problems, which has a great potential to become even more serious, is the question of developing tourism. We have a huge hotel here on a beach, which is very important for nesting, and this is only the beginning. There are plans to develop more tourism here, with golf courses, residential areas, and much more.
According to the 26-year-old camp coordinator, this is a big problem because on the Cape Verdean Islands, there is still little sympathy for conserving the turtles. But that's changing, says Christian.
The foundation's image has improved among locals. They've come to know us. We placed a lot of emphasis on not just being the organization that patrols the beaches with guards. We're also active in schools and projects that are important for improving lives here, like supporting sports associations, for example. The Turtle Foundation aims to be a welcome part of the community, one that people don't see as a threat to incomes.
Through this approach, the organization also gained local partners.
We had a very important victory this year, which has to do with financing turtle protection on a beach called Varadinha. The Turtle Foundation is working with the Fishermen's Association there. The fishermen decided that they would no longer catch turtles, and in return, the Turtle Foundation gives them financial support.
Amanda, the camp coordinator, is clearly enthusiastic about this achievement. But Christian Roda, the project manager, knows there is still a long way to go.
It's difficult to measure how much people's outlook has changed.
But Christian also says the organization's surveys show that its message may be getting through the younger generations, offering the chance of a brighter future for the turtles that nest on Boa Vista. Carla Fernandes, Deutsche Welle Radio, on Boa Vista Island, Cape Verde.
Time now for a quick look at some environment news from the past week. Here's Jesse Wingard.
Eco News. A business poll suggests many German enterprises are unprepared for changes to the supply of carbon permits after 2013. According to the CO2 barometer survey conducted by Germany's KfW Development Bank, only 40% of German companies have evaluated the costs associated with the next round of Europe's emissions trading scheme. The scheme covers about 11,000 factories and power plants across the bloc. It forces them to buy permits for each tonne of carbon dioxide they emit, pushing down their combined emissions with a steadily decreasing cap. US scientists say the amount of space junk orbiting the Earth is reaching dangerous proportions. NASA is currently tracking some 22,000 pieces of debris and estimates that millions are too small to track. The objects threaten Earth's satellite communications. In a study published this week, a committee chaired by former NASA officials said clouds of space junk could soon cross a tipping point because collisions generate even more debris. In recent years, the collision of two satellites and a Chinese weapons test have compounded the amount of junk orbiting the Earth. United States President Barack Obama has put a stop to new rules that would limit smog pollution. Obama said the decision was designed to reduce the regulatory burdens for business. The draft law would have authorized the country's Environmental Protection Agency to regulate air quality standards more tightly, but has been fiercely opposed by Republican lawmakers. The American Lung Association said it would resume the legal fight on smog standard that it first launched against Obama's predecessor. A Greenpeace stunt in the Arctic has recreated a giant version of one of Leonardo da Vinci's most famous images, the Vitruvian Man, to draw attention to shrinking ice levels there. Summer levels of sea ice in the Arctic have dropped precipitously since measurements began there in the 1970s. Observers are waiting to see if this year's measurements, due out this month, drop below the record low set in 2007. A team of scientists accompanied the Greenpeace voyage to measure the thickness of the Arctic ice. Some experts say part of the reason that summer ice cover has shrunk dramatically is because it has been thinning for decades and that 2010 was in fact the lowest level of sea ice on record.
Jesse Wingard there with the environment news. And if you're looking for more environment content, come check out our webpage at dwworld.de/environment. Finally today, greenwashing. 100% biodegradable, pesticide-free, sustainably produced, CO2 neutral. These days, many product labels suggest their manufacturers are greener than Kermit the Frog. Here in Germany, as the number of climate-conscious consumers keen to buy environmentally friendly products increases, so too is the number of companies looking to paint lush green images of themselves to profit from the trend. But how much substance is behind all these shiny green profiles? Leah McDonnell went looking for answers in Berlin.
Does the growing green tint on the corporate landscape reflect a real shift towards sustainable, energy-efficient industrial practices? Or is it nothing more than glitzy green window dressing? Henrik Wacht from Berlin's Chamber of Commerce and Industry says companies are implementing more environmentally friendly practices, and not just to present a pretty green face to customers.
But I think it's always a bundle of motivations or a bundle of drivers. It's environmental regulation, it's customer demand, commitment for climate protection, and it's saving costs. So it's always a bundle of different drivers that drive companies to really invest in environmental protection.
Labels on a growing number of products these days profess fantastic climate-friendly claims like emissions-free or sustainably produced. Reinhold Benich from Friends of the Earth Germany says this kind of green advertising is not worth the paper it's printed on due to lax labeling laws in Germany and the European Union.
Greenwashing is allowed in the European Union on a level which is not acceptable. So in Europe, companies are allowed to write anything on the products in relation to CO2 because we don't have a law directly on that.
So, climate-conscious Germans who diligently recycle and strive to reduce their carbon footprint by shopping responsibly are in danger of being fooled into thinking they're doing the right thing by unverified claims on labels, often designed to look like an officially certified seal. On the streets of Berlin, many shoppers say they're skeptical about the truth of labels.
I think that green labeling is often misused as an advertising gimmick. You need to look at a company's environmental track record and listen to independent experts' assessment of products.
I think it's important that labels for green products have seals certifying their environmental standards, so I know which products to trust.
Interestingly, a number of younger Germans expressed a remarkable amount of trust in the integrity of companies' grand green professings.
I don't think there's any greenwashing going on. Rather, that things are changing. I don't have any doubts that the claims in the labels are true.
Whether it's cars, fuel, electricity or food, companies from all major industrial sectors are launching ad campaigns highlighting environmental incentives that can create a false impression of the company's actual environmental engagement. Take the European utilities provider Vattenfall. The energy giant boasts its use of biomass in northern European power plants, claiming biomass emits 90% less carbon per energy unit than coal, and we're using it. How great and green it sounds! Before the numbers put things in perspective. Fact is, a mere 1% of Vattenfall's total energy output is derived from biomass. Henrik Wacht admits unbalanced disclosure of the ratio of green to overall corporate undertakings can mislead customers.
The problem is not about the projects that the companies do. The problem is about how do they communicate it, and do they communicate it as now they are number one in environmental protection, or do they communicate it as one step in their company profile to become greener?
Going green can often open up a lot of gray areas. Illustrating this is one recent case involving the international food giant Danone. The company worked with the environmental group, the Worldwide Fund for Nature, to develop new eco-friendly packaging for its yogurt product Activia, using cornstarch instead of regular plastic. It was a high-profile move, but one that backfired. Another environmental watchdog took a closer look and found that the new packaging was actually worse than the old one when land use, soil and water contamination, and fine particle pollution were taken into account. It's now suing Danone for consumer fraud. Greenwashing gets even more complicated when power, posing and politics get involved. Reinhold Benig from Friends of the Earth Germany claims the European Union is allowing unsustainably produced biofuels, whose carbon impact is even greater than that of fossil fuels, to be imported to Europe. Why? To allow countries to meet official European Union biofuel targets. How ironic that legislation initially created to protect the environment can serve to harm it when looking green is more important than being green. In addition, Benig says claims made by governments and companies in general about emission savings and reductions have little validity because
we have today no agreement on how to count CO2 emissions, which is accepted worldwide. We have four different methods to measure CO2 emissions, and so scientists all over the world are still discussing which method is the best one. That means we are in the moment not able to say the truth about CO2 emissions.
However, it's not all gloom and doom when it comes to green business. In the German capital, things are a bit more encouraging. Berlin's local economy is dominated by small and medium-sized enterprises with direct contact to their customers and community. Henrik Vogt says this keeps them transparent and actively engaged in pro-climate solutions.
The risk of greenwashing that some people fear is not as high in Berlin as somewhere else. What we recognize or what we see in small and medium enterprises is really a high commitment for climate protection and environmental protection, because the customer awareness is very high. People are very quick to have opinions about greenwashing ads, and so companies are very careful not to promote things that aren't really green, I would say.
Perhaps when it comes to green schemes, keeping it local and simple are the best ways to ensure that what is green on the surface is green to the core. Take the organic food sector, a growing part of the food industry that retained its local grassroots nature by developing its own certification schemes that have higher standards and enjoy higher consumer trust than government-issued ones. Even Reinhold Spenig gives it a thumbs up.
I think what is really good is the organic farming certification. The organic farmers themselves defended against greenwashing because they know credibility is quite important for their sector.
Seems like no matter how well-intended a green action may be at first, the more complex it becomes and the more players involved, the easier it is for greenwashing to occur. What is crystal clear is that assessing what is truly green in the corporate world today is no simple black and white endeavor. Leah McDonald, Deutsche Welle Radio in Berlin.
And that's all for this week. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you liked the show. If you're looking for more of our content, remember that webpage again. It's dwworld.de/environment. Till next week, I'm Nathan Witkop. Bye for now.